Welcome to MoneyWeb Now. Business news every morning.
Wednesday, 8 January. David Bowie was born today, 1947. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and recorded from studios in Rosebank. On the show today, chatting with Keith McLachlan, CIO at Integral Investment Management. I want to talk around management. How do we know they're doing a good job? How do we know what they're actually being paid to do? Yes, run the business, but which particular parts are their KPIs and the like? And then investing offshore, his thoughts, and frankly, some of those small cap offshore funds beating the heck out of big tech. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
I'm chatting with Keith McLachlan, CIO at Integral Investment Management. Keith, appreciate the time. I want to start with management, and I want to particularly start with something that I've heard you say often, but I want to dig into it a little bit more. But what's hugely important in a listed company, or any company, but of course we're interested in the listed space, is figuring how is management incentivized?
Absolutely, Simon. First of all, good to be here. But you know, there's a saying that show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. Mm. And management, just like anybody else, and this doesn't make them good or bad, it just makes them human. Yeah. If they've got a significant bonus or a huge number of KPIs that are lined up with a big payout at the end of it, well, they're going to try to hit the KPIs. Mm. So you and key performance indicators for those who don't know what KPIs are. So understanding what those incentives are for management helps you understand how they're going to run a business. And don't forget, at the end of the day, businesses are not random sets of numbers. They're actually collections of people doing activities and tasks that pull in a direction. Mm. So what that direction is very, very key. And, you know, the best indicator in the long term for what they direction is, it's probably going to be management KPIs, management bonuses, management incentives. And it's not always as simple as just what is written in their bonus structure. You got to understand that there are companies out there where management are in fact the founders and all large shareholders in the business. And which incentive overshadows which one? Getting their bonus, is that the important goal that they're shooting for? Or building shareholder value because they, in fact, themselves are large shareholders? Which one overrules which one is also worth considering?
You raise a number of points I want to come to. The first is, where do I find this data? Is this going to be in the annual report?
So short answer, it should be. full disclosure should be there. Often they like to bury it into large numbers of very flowery words and notes.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, for example, in America, you can often find these in the proxy statements, building up, you know, American listed companies and proxy statements that get voted in AGMs and shareholder meetings, things like this. But it, in theory, somewhere out there, it should be disclosed.
And does it then, and you mentioned, you know, there's obviously their KPIs, which is, you know, how they do their day-to-day job. But if they are a founder, they're probably a significant shareholder, perhaps a majority shareholder. Does it mean that smaller companies, because I'm thinking top 40, there's no founder who's still there with, you know, 20% or something. Does it mean that small caps are perhaps almost more inclined for share? And I'm trying to think, just because they've got that key incentive to get the share price up as well as everything else.
So large management shareholdings are two-edged blade. Mm. And what I mean by that is, on the one hand, they're invested alongside you as a shareholder, assuming there's only one class of share.
Yeah, yeah.
And we can circle back around to that comment. But I have seen before management or people running businesses using their controlling slug of equity to keep themselves in a position where they can pay themselves large salaries and bonuses. What I mean by that is profits are shared with all shareholders. But if you're in control, you pay yourself an inflated remuneration package, well, you don't share that with shareholders. That goes 100% to you. So it's in considering where the alignment of incentives lies and where the balance of this is, where you've got companies with large insider holding that run the business, work through their remuneration and consider whether it is inflated or not. And in some instances, it's clearly not. And I'll give you an example. Offshore, there's Geronimo Martin that's controlled, sure, I think for 150 years by the same family. And the family is very involved in the business. They scattered across the boards and the committees, and they're there. They're very, very, this is their business. They're running it. But go and have a look at their remuneration, and they pay themselves laughably low salaries. That gives me the indication that they're worried about the bottom line. They're not abusing their position, and they're managing it because they earn more in terms of uplift of share price than they would out of a couple bonuses. But there are plenty of examples of the complete opposite. I mean, go back even on the local market, the previous management of NASPERS, which, and circling back to that point, has a control structure that's unlisted. Yeah. And they got paid ludicrous amounts of money to arguably destroy value. And clearly they didn't have to pander to listed shareholders. They just had to make sure the unlisted controlling ones liked them. And who knows what discussions are happening in the background, but that's an example of where things are misaligned, deeply misaligned.
Yeah, there's a stock in America, and I can't remember, it's an industrial. Family owns 51% and basically pays all profit as bonuses. And well, if you're silly enough to be a shareholder, nothing you can do about it. Last question on the KPIs. Yeah. It's in the, and assuming we've found that data, is there a red flag in a KPI which for you would be a deal breaker? Or is it to your earlier point, which is, you know, they fit within a larger picture?
So when working through the individual KPIs, I like financial targets. And I like targets that cannot be bought. What I mean by that is, say, for example, there's a target of revenue must grow by 20%. Oh, geez, I can go and do an acquisition and magically wave my wand and revenue is growing by 20%. Mm-hmm. But if it says ROE has to be minimum 20%. Mm-hmm. ROE is very hard to manipulate, but not impossible. I mean, I could gear up the company. So think about each of the incentives and think of how it can be abused. And the big red flags, you know, there's a famous whispered story about a CEO in a national airline that will remain nameless that came in, and his major KPI was to achieve EBITDA. And he looked at this, and the way EBITDA works is you strip out depreciation. So all he did was he bought back all the leases they had, and that stopped being OPEX and started becoming depreciation. And nothing in the company had changed, but EBITDA was high enough.
Yeah.
And he got his bonus. So think about how it can be abused, and particularly via acquisitions. That tends to be the big lever that abuses things. And that's what I think about in terms of this space. Because KPIs, there should be a number of offsetting KPIs. You know, maybe it's growth in revenue, which you can buy, but you can't. But, you know, it also needs growth in EPS, so it's got to trickle down. And, in fact, there needs to be a minimum ROE hit, and debt to equity can't breach a certain level. You know, so you see how they all offset each other, and it's very hard to gain that KPI set.
I like that. There are some which you can just absolutely buy, and those are the dangerous ones. Staying with management and staying local. So in the local environment, you've been in this industry, particularly in the small cap. You've widened that brief, but particularly in the small cap. And you can pretty much phone up management of a listed company, and they'll have a cup of tea or a lunch with you or something. I imagine in the offshore space where you've expanded more recently, that is a lot harder. Does it make your job harder, or are, you know, the transcripts and earnings calls enough, or perhaps some distance from management isn't always a bad thing?
All of the above. But let me break it down. I mean, and we can't just lump offshore into one basket. Mm-hmm. There's very much developed economy offshore, and undeveloped,
yeah.
or fringe or peripheral. You know, that for example, if you start digging below the surface in the Japanese market, some of those companies, investor relations sites, don't even have English translation.
Yeah.
You know, but at least they have websites. So some of the Vietnamese companies, it gets even wilder and wilder the further you go. But, you know, you hit UK, Europe, US, and those are pretty sophisticated, pretty Anglo-Saxon orientated investor relations ecosystems, or at least with an English translation, pretty good. So the short answer is a little bit of distance from management isn't a bad thing. It allows you to be a lot more, not to confuse the personality with the investment case. But it does mean that understanding the business models can become a little trickier. So, but typically the investor relations can be quite responsive. So, I mean, reaching out via email with very targeted questions works. But there's lots of earnings calls and transcripts one can work through. And then especially the US 10Q, 10K filings are actually quite detailed. One can work through those and that, we're talking about. Probably the average company is about 150 pages of disclosure there that has quite a large amount in it. So there's lots of tools to work through. I would avoid those markets without English translations. There's a lot of stocks out there. You don't have to be an expert in all of them. Focus on the ones you can understand, or of the ones you can understand, focus on those you like. Allocation is time.
Yeah, actually, good point. I spoke with someone who has a frontier markets fund, and his first port of call, as you point out, is like getting translators for French and for Japanese and et cetera, and French particularly because of Francophone. In a sense, I mean, as I said, you've got that offshore AMC now, which means you've also got more offshore. It's become a more globalized market. We don't just look at SA anymore.
No.
I mean, what are the big benefits? I mean, to me, the obvious one is just range. I mean, you and I probably know a little bit about every stock on the JSE. You go offshore, like we didn't even, it's negligible. Is it quarterly earnings? I mean, what is perhaps the big advantage of offshore, aside from the range and the globalization of it?
So, you've answered your question. I would argue the big benefit is there's more options, which, by the way, doesn't mean you pick the right ones, but it can. It does mean that if it doesn't tick most, if not all of your boxes, we'll move on. You'll find something that does. You know, just because it's listed doesn't mean you need to be invested. But there's a range of other benefits as well, because, I mean, particularly as a South African investor, typically in those listing will tend to be as well. Our market is about 1% of global market. You know, that means that you actually want diversification in offshore. It's not even just about returns, it's about diversification. And particularly in this space where you have a large number of options, where you can find companies where there's only a few that operate in the industry, you know, like you can really build true diversification the more options you have. So one, you can pick better upside or opportunity sets via the options. Mm-hmm. And two, you can use that to build greater diversification. Personally, I'd be quite happy if there was not quarterly reporting, because it's so short-term in nature, and the volume that gets pumped out by these companies is overwhelming. And for what benefit? I mean, I'd be quite happy if listed companies reported once a year.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Not even twice.
Yeah, 100%. I absolutely agree. I mean, I don't know what we would do for the other half of the year, but we would find something. We would find something to do. And I don't know how Americans manage the quarterly. So I want to dig into a little more offshore, because I was digging through and two stocks. I don't know if they're still in your fund. Sprouts and Lotus. Lotus makes biscuits, literally, and Sprouts sells vegetables and stuff. But I was digging returns. Everyone's always so, we talk tech. So here's a fun fact. NASDAQ and the last year is up 33%. We've got Lotus up 97%, Sprouts up 187%. In 3 years, NASDAQ's up 37%, Sprouts up 417%, Lotus up 600-odd. I mean, there are boring non-tech stocks out there that if you find them, and I appreciate it takes some digging, there are returns out there that are spectacular, and it doesn't need to be Mag 7.
No, absolutely not. I mean, Sprouts Farmers Market for a South African audience, the best way to understand it is somewhere in is effectively the well, the farmers markets like we have in South Africa.
Or Food Lovers or something even.
Oh, Food Lovers. Sorry, that was the business I was thinking of, where it's they've referred to it as a theatre of food. But in the back end, what you don't see is it's surprisingly complex and time sensitive to manage a fresh produce supply chain. And Sprouts has got it right. I mean, Amazon even struggles to compete with them in the areas they are. It's really, really, really great business. But that's not tech. That's not exciting. I mean, Lotus Bakeries makes a really, really good biscuit. You know, like there's different ways you find these businesses. And one of the ways is relative valuations, where this is how I located Sprouts, is in terms of valuing retail companies around the world, create a scatter plot, you know, with opposing metrics like ROE and price to book, you know, sales growth and price earnings, et cetera, et cetera. And it doesn't always show that the stock you're looking at is the one worth investing. There's outliers that pop up, and Sprouts popped up, and that's where I went down a rabbit hole and I discovered them, and they look really, really good on paper. I got to understand the story and the management change and where they're going, and they performed fantastically, and there's probably still lots of legs, lots of Sprouts there to go. Lotus Bakeries was discovered via its products. I mean, these companies aren't in vacuums. They're in the same world we're in. And when you encounter a great service or a great product, you know, ask yourself, where does it come from? And backward finds the company. And sometimes they list it, and sometimes they're well run. And Lotus Bakeries is an example, much like Geronimo Martins that we were talking about earlier, where it's family built, family controlled. They don't abuse their position. I think it's third or fourth generation currently running it. They're very much focused on the quality of their product, getting it out into the world. And they're just a spectacular business. And they've done really, really well. And, you know, long may it last.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, yeah, biscuit makers, who knew? A last question. You mentioned around time as your sort of your currency in a sense. You've got a finite amount of time. Those 10 Qs, 10 Ks are giant documents. Those are obviously when you own the stock. But when you're doing that digging, I mean, how much time would you give a stock before you say, there's just not enough here for me to make a yes decision? And because you could spend a full week of your time going down a rabbit hole around a stock, and at the end of it, you're like, nah, that's not good for me. I mean, is there a cutoff, or is there just like a process and you just keep on thinking sort of, and then at some point you pull the plug?
So I would say there's almost like a negative filter. Mm-hmm. So once you've identified through, you know, there's various ways to generate ideas to fund, and some of them are quite incidental. But if you're aware of them, lots of things pop up on radars and you go, you know what, let's go have a look at that. And probably within 10 to 20 minutes, you know whether it's worth looking more.
Okay.
And there's red flags to look like, to see, for example, massive loss making, way out of whack valuation. You know, a company that's been listed for a very long time and gone nowhere. So what's changed then? Well, the question is, what's changed? You know, you perhaps have a deeply illiquid share or massive, that like as you're working through, lots of things can jump out. Or like, for example, just awful cash flow statement. Awful cash flow statement with massive debt on the balance sheet. I mean, that's a clear red flag. Just like, don't think this is worth looking more. Let's move on. But you know, assuming no red flags pop up in the first kind of 10, 20 minutes of quickly, at first glance, what does the business do? Second glance, what do the numbers look like? And if it passes that sort of check, you can start going down further rabbit holes and going, okay, you know, what do competitors look like? What is the management strategy? What are shareholdings and KPIs, and what were we chatting about? And starting to line up the dots so that you actually start to arrive at the end of that with a defendable investment case for why you're in this.
I take your point. And I suppose part of that is just decades of experience where quite quickly you say like, it's just not going to work. We'll leave it there. This is Keith McLachlan, CIO, Integral Investment Management. Always appreciate the time. Let your money weather the storms with Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in the Stanlib Global Select Fund, a diversified all-weather equity portfolio submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
That's it for today. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobokle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow.
Listen to the live stream of MoneyWeb Now at the same time every weekday. For more business, finance, and investment news. MoneyWeb Now. On the money. Also available on podcast.